Good morning from 94.7 WPVC LP Charlottesville. And welcome to our election special candidates forum. As each Saturday this month, we speak to one candidate running for local or state office. The program is brought to you with support from Rebecca's Natural Food and Hamilton's at First and Main. Now here are your hosts, Bob McAdams and Jeff Leonard.
Good Saturday morning, Charlottesville. I'm Jeff Leonard, General Manager at 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville.
And I'm Bob McAdams, Special Events Coordinator at WPVC.
Today we're co-hosting a WPVC election special, one of our interviews with Democratic candidates for the Albemarle County Board of Supervisors. Keep in mind, WPVC does not endorse any candidate for public office. We provide this information to you, our listeners, to help choose the best candidate for them.
With us in the studio this morning is Board of Supervisors candidate Gerard Smith. Gerard, welcome to WPVC.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Gerard, let's start by getting to know a little bit about you. Where were you born and what was your life like as you were growing up?
Great. I actually love that question. So I was actually born right out in Barbersville, Virginia. So I like to think of that as wine country. But I'm a little country kid. Had the ability to just grow up out in the country, running through the streets barefoot. So my life was a little different than a lot of, well, similar to most middle Virginia and rural Virginia, but different in a lot of ways that I was kind of an only child. So literally the people are who raised me. So that's why I place a huge emphasis on the people so much. That's all I had to make me who I am today.
And from the running in the streets barefoot, your education and your work background, how have they prepared you to serve as a member of the Albemarle County Board of Supervisors?
Great. So I'm one of those nerdy kids. Always been one of the nerdy kids. Went through the entire Albemarle school system, so you can thank the Albemarle school system for all of that. So Stony Point Elementary School, Sutherland Middle School, Albemarle High School. Then went away to Bucknell.
So go Bison.
Go Bison. So while at Bucknell, I noticed that economics and policy kind of went hand in hand. So I chose a double major in economics and political science, seeing the connection between the two. I then came back to the area and then decided to pursue my master's in public policy, kind of just furthering that connection between economics and policy. And so that's where academically what led me here today. On the private side, I do financial forecasting for a pharmaceutical company in town. So I run the numbers all day, making sure we have money from quarter to quarter. So I sit in Excel, rarely talk to people. So I actually welcome this opportunity to have some interaction.
Well, we're glad to provide some conversation for you. Gerard, you're seeking the nomination for supervisor from the Ravenna District.
Yes.
Now, if elected, your decisions are going to affect everybody in Albemarle. But what area does the Ravenna District cover?
Great. So we've actually got a big area that's mixed with suburban and rural areas. So it's the Keswick area, it's the Pantops area, travel on down Profit Road. We have Hollymead, Baker Butler, and of course, my home precinct, my home area, Stony Point. So we've got a pretty big area.
You're listening to 94.7 WPVC's Albemarle Board of Supervisors Candidate Forum. I'm Jeff Leonard. With us in studio today is Gerard Smith. Gerard, how have you been active in recent years to help improve Albemarle County?
Great. So in addition to being a regular citizen and coaching and things of that nature, about 3 years ago, I got involved in the Democratic Party. I went to one of their breakfasts and got connected, and I became the Democratic co-chair for the Ravenna District, which at first I was like, oh, this is cool. But it really gave me a chance to meet people that are extremely involved in that care from all different backgrounds all across the county. And so I really was working on that, building up the district with my co-chair. And we really took it from nothing to a place where we've kind of got some things going. We've got some good things happening. We've got pockets of people that are willing to help us get out the Democratic message and things of that nature. So I've been involved doing that other than being a citizen. So,
you know, running for a board of supervisors is a big deal. It takes a lot of sacrifice. Why did you decide to run? Why now?
Why now? So I guess I'm crazy. Kidding.
You have to be a little bit.
But no, as I mentioned earlier, the people in this area have given so much to me. And I come from a segment of the population that often does not have their voice represented. So I'm an African-American kid coming from a low income background out in the county. Fortunately, this county has some things in place that a few, if given the right opportunities, a few of us from lower income statuses can make it. And make it meaning be a successful and productive citizen, not make it as in $1 million. We can take that as relative as you want to take it, but I don't want people to think that I'm some billionaire that just happened to come from Elmhurst County. But the people are what make me want to run because they made me who I am today. So I felt like this would be a chance for me to give back to the people and kind of open some doors and break some barriers for others to come behind me. As a candidate, and you'll see with all of my policies and my platform, I'm all about creating opportunities and I'm all about breaking barriers. I want to make one that it, no matter what background you come from, whether you move here, whether you retire here, that you can live your best life here. So I'm just trying to do the best I can to make that a reality.
You're listening to 94.7 WPVC's Board of Supervisors Candidate Forum. I'm Bob McAdams. And with us in the studio today is Gerard Smith. Gerard, the events of 2017, including Charlottesville City Council's debate and vote on the statues, the July 8th KKK rally, and the Unite the Right rallies on August 11th and August 12th, they traumatized our community. One group of white supremacists almost held a rally in Dardantown Park. Mm-hmm. If some group wanted to hold a potentially violent event in the county, what should the Board of Supervisors do about it?
I don't think that those events should be allowed. I'll just start by saying, point one, trauma is real. And I know that trauma is real firsthand. So I'll give you an example. And it's a personal example, but I'll give it to you nonetheless. So I had to be in like third grade. Was staying up late one night, and I believe it was NBC 20, maybe been 2020. I can't remember the exact station. And they were putting on trial a white supremacist who, and during that course, now mind you, I'm still a child at this point, and they played a song and they were using it as evidence against the white supremacist. And that song had so much hatred and so much just negative things that it literally mentally shut me down. I had to go see a school psychologist. And luckily, Almar, Stony Point Elementary at that time had a great guidance counselor. I wish I could remember his name, but thank you to him for helping me get through it. But that shut me down for like 3 or 4 months. So trauma with those things is real and we can't overlook it. And I feel like for a long time with extremist groups, because they tend to target, not tend to target, because they target a population that doesn't really have a political voice, sometimes that gets lost. But we can't allow things like that to happen in the county. Now trauma is real, and it's not just trauma for the people in the area and the businesses. We have to think about our kids and how they have to go through it. There are kids today that I'm sure still aren't sleeping well, or that are having trouble in school as a result of those rallies. Trauma is real. And with those extremist groups and the hate groups, we can't allow it. And so even if it's, and we can do everything in our legal power to not allow it, but I'm always going to stand against it.
That's a great point about kids. As you know, I remember after August 12th, I had to take my kids down on Tuesday night just to show them that their community was a safe place, just exactly, so that they could begin the healing process.
Exactly. It's about more than, I think sometimes with the events of August 12th and the hate that's going on in this country right now, we forget that there are children that have to grow up and that are impressionable and they have to live through these things. And sometimes as adults, we can push it to the side sometimes. We can go spend money at the downtown mall and we can somewhat get back to our regular lives. But for kids, they have to live this every day. And sometimes they don't even know how to deal with a classmate that's mean to them. And now we're asking kids from all different backgrounds to deal with a hate group that came through the county. So I'm a little sensitive to it.
Now, the events of July and August 2017 also uncovered covert racism embedded in our institutions. Now, a year and a half has gone by, a little more than that. Where do you think we are now in race relations in Albemarle County, and where are we headed?
Well, I think we know now that there's tension and that the problem exists. It's been there for a while, and the only thing we can do right now is work to mend those institutions, right? So we have to work to make our institutions more inclusive. We have to work to make sure our business environment is more inclusive and that we're doing the best that we can. So all we can do is take steps from here now. We're not going to dismantle the institutions, nor is that the correct answer. What we can do is work to make them better. And we have a lot of work to do. I wish I had the specific answer to solve race relations in the county, but I think an effort to at least provide a more inclusive county could be one that serves the community better moving forward. That's the only way we're going to heal.
Now, many groups and many people in Albemarle calling for more affordable housing. It's not just a city issue. How do you see the problem of affordable housing in both urbanized and rural areas. And what do you think the county should do to increase the availability of affordable housing?
Great. So this is absolutely a loaded question.
Yes, it is. Thanks, Bob.
Thanks, Bob. Absolutely a loaded question. So affordable housing is one of the, and I think one of the advantages of being 29 in the county is that this issue hits home. So I'm recently married of 2 weeks now.
Congratulations.
2 weeks.
Outstanding.
So, and we are looking, and we've been looking for a while at houses in the county, and we realized that it's not affordable. And so it's one of those issues that hits really close to home. The where am I going to live? I understand that home ownership is important. And so it's one of those things where I've been trying to figure it out. And one thing that I can think of is the formulas that we use to determine density and how developers are building new, how they're building new developments. We give bonuses for environmental space, and we also give it bonuses for affordable housing. Maybe we need to really examine as a county our policies, and are our policies and our priorities, are they represented accurately in what we're trying to portray, what we're trying to give across to developers? If we can give the, if we can possibly tweak that formula a little bit and allow more for affordable housing, I would be all for that. But I'm also a person who likes to let the private market drive everything, but we can do what we can and make it a priority and figure it out. I'd love to have some private input on how to make that an actuality in Albemarle County. So.
You know, the Orange Dot Report 3.0 states that 14% of families living in Albemarle do not earn enough to meet basic needs, including housing. These families live in both urbanized and outer rural areas of the county. How do you see the problem of income levels unable to meet living costs? What should the county do about this?
Great question. So first of all, we all know that Albemarle has a ton of income inequality, as you just said. And I think that's part of it. And one thing is that we see the extremes grow. So my response to that is, and I'll give you another personal example, is that my mother used to work at Badger Fire Protection. And that plant left, I want to say this had to be 2007, 2008-ish when they left. And so as a kid in high school, I'm sitting there trying to figure out with my mother, like, hey, what do we do now? Like, I know that she was extremely smart, things like that. We're trying to figure out what exactly do we do. So at that, literally at that exact moment is when my ideas on economic freedom came to me. And so I'm big on small businesses. I'm big on people taking their economic freedom into their own hands. I think we need more entrepreneurs in the county, and we need to support our small businesses, because I think that there is an opportunity, contrary to popular belief, that we can grow our economy from the community up. And so that's the approach that I take, is that if we can have people start their own businesses, maybe they run them on the side, maybe they do them full time, maybe we have a shot at breaking down that economic inequality and less cash strapping people. I can't tell businesses how much they should pay their employees. I would love for everyone to earn a living wage throughout the county and throughout the area in general. But the minimum that I know that we can do is we can try our best to empower our small businesses and take a look at our policies and our economic environment and see where we can get better in that aspect. If the county can't provide the groundwork for everyone to become less cash strapped, maybe we can give some of the power to the people and let them do it on their own.
You know, your district is unique, at least the district that you're running for is unique, is that you have the gentried landowners and farm owners on Stony Point Road up 20, but then you cross over through some more rural areas and into a sort of an urban growth area up on 29 North. How are you going to balance sort of the needs of both of those? You know, they're not counter needs, but these folks have different needs. How do you plan on balancing that?
Great. And so as a candidate that's from here, I understand the needs of the area. Born and raised, so I understand what areas serve my needs. I understand that when I go out to Stony Point, I'm Barbersville to my house, that I like the peace and quiet. And I understand that when I need something, that I have to go to those more urban areas. So this actually gives me the chance to run as a candidate that can represent both. So nothing that I say to you is going to be fake. Nothing is going to be manufactured to get votes. I really mean the things that I say. So when I understand that rural areas want to stay rural and that urban areas need what they need, it's important to me. So I'm running as the best candidate to get those things done. And it's definitely a balancing act. We have different needs. And I think that being from here, growing up, experienced things and coming back and as an adult and now a working professional in this area, it kind of gives me first level insight into the different things that we need. And I think that previously there's been a disconnect between community and the people. And so one of the things that I'm trying to do is make sure that we can connect this community to the people a little bit. I know we have different needs, but at least we can do is try to connect everybody and make this county one for all.
Well, thanks, Gerard. It's a great discussion. We're going to take a short break. And we're back. I'm Jeff Leonard. I'm co-hosting with Bob McAdams, the 94.7 WPVC election special interview with Board of Supervisors candidate Gerard Smith. Bob and Gerard, we're talking about the issues.
And here is another tough issue. The New York Times ProPublica report on the achievement gap between the races in both Charlottesville and Albemarle schools that alarmed educators, students, parents, residents. Now, the school boards and everyone in both school divisions have tried to address this problem in the past. What can you bring to the Board of Supervisors to help solve it?
Great. So, firsthand experience. So, I'll give you an example. Small kid from second grade out in Stony Point, and the guidance counselor and the principal at that time, who happened to be Pam Moran, noticed.
She's great.
She is incredible. So that was my principal in elementary school. I owe her a lot. So this story comes directly from her because, you know, when you're a kid, you don't remember these stories. Second grade, and somehow some teacher identified me that, hey, this kid should be in the gifted program. And so we're at Stony Point. There's only maybe three, four, five, something like that at that time. And so the guidance counselor comes to my house, talks to my mother, and my mother says, hey, what are you talking about? He's not gifted. What do you mean? You know? And so the guidance counselor had to literally convince my mother to allow me to be in the gifted program. Right? Now, that gifted program, entering that in second grade, kind of set me on a path to with different classes. Everything changes from that moment. You get placed in different classes. You meet different social networks, things like that. And so I think that identification at an early age and involving our kids from all kinds of economic backgrounds, from minorities, just the whole gambit. We really have to work on identifying these kids at an early age and exposing them to different issues. We also have to work on our baseline, right? So we have to make sure that each kid is getting the education that's best for them. But we also should know that we have to focus on not shutting the door on young kids because it sets them up for life. So I'm an example of someone who got a small opportunity just in the educational system. And it opened a lot of different doors for me at an early age. So I think we have to work on taking a really in-depth look at our elementary education system and work on how can we identify kids and do what's best for them at an early age. So I think it starts early. I think that's the answer. And I think from there we can build out the resources and things necessary to allow our kids to be best and do what we can to close that gap.
Having health care available when you need it, it's just an absolute necessity. You're sick. You got to have the health care. And all people have that need. Mm-hmm. Getting care for mental illness is even more of a challenge. There are limits to insurance coverage, and there's a lack of professionals in the field. And that means that many people with mental health problems, they go untreated. What should the county do to help people who are suffering with mental illness?
So, full disclaimer, my wife is, it feels funny to say wife, but my wife is a psychologist. She got her PhD at UVA. She's a clinical psychologist. So this mental health issue invades our household on a daily basis. And so I think as a county, let's take a look and see if we can provide more resources to our mental health services. We know that it's a huge need and we know that insurance won't cover it. I also think the county should push for possibly working with our state legislatures and even our senators and our federal representatives to see if we can get insurance to expand, right? Like the conversation has to be started. Like we know that it exists. We know that coverage needs to expand. If we're going to treat it as a real issue in society, then we're going to have to look at expanding and get the coverage. It's hard enough for people out here to fall down and break an arm and go to the hospital, let alone have somebody diagnose you with a mental health issue or get the treatment that you need. So I think it's going to take work with levels. It's going to take a look at can we fund different services on a local level. And it's also going to take the county really placing an emphasis on working with those higher up on the representative food chain to see if we can get some funding and see if, what we can do to some of these laws to address this mental health issue that we have.
You're listening to 94.7 WPVC's Albemarle Board of Supervisors Candidate Forum. I'm Jeff Leonard. With us in studio today is Gerard Smith. Gerard, mental illness leads to our criminal justice system. The superintendent of the regional jail, Martin Coomer, who's a great guy, has said that 50% of the people in jail suffer from one form of mental illness or the other, and 80% have substance abuse problems. What changes in our criminal justice system are needed, and what can the county do to address these needs?
Great. So I think it goes back to funding. I think we can really take a look and see if we can fund some mental health services program and maybe diagnose some of these people a little bit sooner. And I think that's really all that we really can do with mental health issues, right? Is try to help these people earlier in the game, and also see if we can dedicate some resources to our jails to help those people while they're in jail. These are real issues that don't just go away because you lock somebody up. So I guess the answer comes down to how much of an emphasis are we going to place on rehabilitation versus incarceration? Which one do we value more, and can we help these people? Is our goal to help or is our goal to hide, right? I think that's a real issue that we have to ask ourselves as a county.
That's sort of the constant challenge. Is the criminal justice system made to punish or is it made to rehabilitate? And exactly. I think you can get 50,000 different answers on that. I know what mine is. Statistics reveal another issue with criminal justice, and that is systemic racism, from the police stops to prosecutors to incarceration. Whites have a clear advantage over people of color. Recently, an African-American family was forced to the ground at gunpoint by Albemarle County police officers. What can the county do to make sure that all members of our community can trust that the justice system is equally administered by our police officers, prosecutors, judges, probation, and even prison staff?
Great. So I'll start by saying that event, I understand that in the moment things are tough. Absolutely get it from the job of our police officers. But acts like that aren't acceptable. And so I challenge anybody that's not from the African-American background or a minority in the county or just in general across the nation to think about how you would feel if that happened to your family. I think sometimes when these acts happen, that we forget that at the other end of these acts are humans, right? And so as a human, is that something that you would want to happen to your family, your friends, your loved ones, your child in the backseat, right? Is that something that you would want to happen? So to address that, I think that our institutions need more training and more sensitive cultural training, right? They need to know that different cultures react to things different ways. They need to see the humanity in people. And I know it's hard and I know it sounds crazy, but we're asking our institutions and our state-sponsored like enforcement agencies to see the humanity in people. I think that comes with training. I think that comes with time. But it's a cry for humanity. And that's all we can do is train and hope for the best. But at the same time, we can't allow these acts to go to be accepted and to be glanced over. These are real people. These are real humans. We're asking for humanity, not for anything crazy.
You're listening to 94.7 WPVC's Albemarle Board of Supervisors Candidate Forum. I'm Bob McAdams. Gerard, recent reports from scientists tell us that the climate change crisis is much worse than previously understood, with years, not decades, to act. Young people who understand the urgency of this crisis are condemning the lack of action by older people who are in positions of power. What should Albemarle County government do to accelerate reduction of its own greenhouse gas emissions and encourage residents to do the same?
Great. So one thing that I would say is that climate change is tough and complicated, but I do think that we can, as a county, set the standard. So I think that even if we want to take a look at creating kind of an energy savings kind of master plan that really examines like regionally throughout the county, energy usage, things of that nature, and ways that we can cut that down, I think that would be beneficial. I think for new building standards, we need to make sure that we set the standard for the world in terms of how environmentally efficient our buildings and our energy usage is. And I think we could make some changes. I would also love to see maybe the exploration, and I'm not declaring this, but I would love to see possibly a study from county staff on maybe what it would look like to give tax incentives for environmental friendly things, such as if you place a solar pack on your house, or something of that nature. What does it look like? And if we're going down that route of being environmental friendly, we should explore as a county more charging stations for electric vehicles, things of that nature. Those are all realistic things that we can, those are all realistic steps that we can take. And I think it comes with wanting to do it as a county, and the county wants to do it. And they're taking steps to do that. And I think we can take those steps a little bit further. But when we take those steps a little bit further with tax incentives and building incentives and charging stations, I just want to make sure that we're taking a look at how we can allow the common people to partake in this environmental process and not just have it be a top-down issue.
You don't even know. Does the county office building out on Fish Street have electric stations now? I don't even know. I've been out there.
I do not know.
It's right off the interstate. It'd be a great place to put some charging stations.
I agree.
Nature provides the means to capture and sequester CO2, and that's forests. Mm-hmm. Now, forests also prevent erosion. They reduce stormwater runoff. What policies should the county strengthen or create to protect and expand areas with trees?
Great. So I think we need to really make sure that we're enforcing illegal cutting down of trees and anything that we can do in our power to make sure that we're protecting our forests. There's no substitute for trees, as you know. There's no substitute for helping out the environment. I also would love to see maybe community projects starting in the county that encourage citizens to plant more trees and things like that. I would love to explore what it looks like from a community-driven perspective, not just a developer perspective, and we can see where it goes. I would also love to encourage our developers and new developments to really place an emphasis on planting more natural species of trees here in their developments. They don't have to be the biggest trees in the world. We're not asking for, what is it, California redwoods that are 800 feet tall, but I think we can do some things to encourage more trees in our green space, and we can do things to encourage setting regulations around how much forest we're going to protect. So,
yeah, every time you go up 29 now, it seems like they've clear-cut another swath.
I understand that, too.
And I was driving on Polo Grounds Road the other day, and all these deer are running in the road, and my children are like, where are all these deer coming from?
Yep.
So they used to live right over there, and now they're searching.
Yep, I understand that.
So here's the hard question.
Mm-hmm.
Over the years, Albemarle County Comprehensive Plan has concentrated development in growth areas.
Mm-hmm.
As I was mentioning, on 29 North, near Pantops, which makes it almost impossible to get to the interstate sometimes of the day, mm-hmm. around Crozet, and in the urban ring surrounding Charlottesville. What planning policies do you support to balance the needs of a growing population, management of infrastructure costs, and providing affordable housing to protect protecting the environment?
Great. So I'm all about connectivity. And so growing up here and seeing all of this development, so I'm 29, full disclaimer, I'm 29. But that's 29 years of development, things that I've seen the county change. So for the listeners that have been here for a while, you guys understand, boy, guys and girls, understand the changes that have happened in the last 30 years. And so I think that there's a disconnect. And I think that for our planning, we need to get back to trying to connect the people to our community and our environment. There's no reason why we shouldn't have well-lit. This is really simple, really basic, but well-lit crosswalks, right? Well-lit crosswalks on Pantops on 29. There's no way for people to get safely right now from 29, from let's just use an example, the Arby's on 29 to Target. There's no way that anyone's going to advocate for their son or daughter to cross four lanes of traffic. Well, it's actually more than four lanes now, but five lanes of traffic to get to a shopping center. So I think that in our planning process, we have to really concentrate and get back to a people first idea and figure out how can we connect people to our community and to our environment. And really take a look at that. And I don't know, let's make this place that people can actually, well, people enjoy it now, but that people can connect to and enjoy on a personal level.
Yeah, we've got that problem here at the radio station where if you want to get over across the street to where Costco is, you've got to go across, I think, 2 6-lane highways at 45. If you want to catch the bus heading sort of into town rather than catch the bus to ride all the way up, you know, around Walmart and back. So
yeah,
we definitely know what that's about. changing our patterns of transportation, speaking of transportation, is necessary. It's necessary to reduce carbon emissions. Mm-hmm. But public transportation in the county extends north only to Sam's Club and south to Southwood, east of Pantops, including the hospital, and not at all to the west. What changes do you propose to make public transportation a viable alternative to a single-occupant car travel? I'll tell you what, I would love to take the bus to the airport.
I hear you, and I second that sentiment. So I think we have to make a commitment to it. So right now, it's one of those things where, what do they say, the tail is wagging the dog, right? Is that the phrase? Did I get that right? The tail is wagging the dog. So we haven't made a real commitment to it, and therefore it hasn't been effective. So we say, let's not focus on it, right? Now, if we change that and we say, hey, we're going to commit to it because we want to get less cars off the road and we want to make housing on, for example, Pantops more affordable so that somebody doesn't have to get a car or they use their car as much, we have to put our commitment first. And so with that, I think we should extend it farther down 29 and make it efficient, right? We also need efficiency from our public transportation. We can't be waiting 2 hours for a bus to come. I'm not saying that that's the case, but I'm just saying we have to make sure that it's efficient. We have to make sure that it's available. We have to put our commitment first, and then the rest will follow. Right now, if we don't put our commitment, no one's going to ride the bus because we're not putting our emphasis there, and therefore it's ineffective. And you can lean on the ineffectiveness reasoning behind not doing it. So I think we just reinforce our commitment to it, especially in our urban ring. Do what we can to speed up the efficiency there, and then we can move forward and see where we go. But we have to try first, right? If we don't try, then it never works.
Thanks, Gerard, but we need to take another short break. And we're back. I'm Jeff Leonard, and I'm co-hosting with Bob McAdams a 94.7 WPVC election special interview with Albemarle County Board of Supervisors candidate Gerard Smith. Bob and Gerard, we have one more segment to talk about the issues.
And we've got a tough one. Gerard, 2017 was a year of turmoil that revealed the urgent need to address long-standing problems, including covert racism. Now, the recent conflicts over wearing Confederate symbols in schools illustrate the intensity of feelings on these key issues. What do you see can be done to build respect, confidence in the process, and good order in the relations between the Board of Supervisors and the public?
So with the Confederate symbols, I'll just start by saying, unlike a lot of people, I don't know where my people came from. We found documentation that I want to say my family and my ancestors touched down as bad as around like 1860 out in Barboursville. So when we talk about these symbols, I can't help but think about how these symbols were viewed back during that time. And so for me, it represents, I understand for some, and I'm from this area, so I understand for some it represents heritage. I get it. I understand that argument. But for my people, and I'm speaking my people specifically, it didn't represent that. We never looked at it as a heritage thing. And I'm sure in some cases, if I could go back and talk to some of my ancestors, that it would represent fear, represent an idea of hatred, represent a symbol of literally oppression. So I think the board needs to, I'm not saying they don't understand that because they're all great people, but when we're talking about the idea of imagery and what it really means to underrepresented communities, especially people of color, we have to really think about what that has meant throughout history. And do we want to embrace that? Is that something that we want to fight for? Or is that something that we want to push against? Those symbols all have a deeper meaning. And for the community that I come from, the people that I come from, there's no positivity that comes from that. It represents oppression. And I think that as a board, we should stand against it. Especially in this area. So,
what did you think about the school board meeting and the reaction of the Albemarle Police Department and the Commonwealth's attorney when citizens of Albemarle County were trying to have their voices heard in a, you know, I don't want to interject my opinion on this, but I didn't think it was aggressive in any nature. But what did you think when you saw the video and the footage of what happened at that school board meeting surrounding this, the protest of the Confederate imagery in Charlotte, Alabama public schools?
Sometimes we mistake passion for different things. And so I think that causes overreaction. And sometimes if you expect the situation to go crazy and, well, to go wild and someone gets passionate, then you can see how things can get taken out of hand to kind of maintain order. But I think in that case, it would have been great to have all parties understand that this is a passionate issue and people care about it. And so if they get a little passionate, it doesn't mean that they're going to go wild and go off the rails. It means that they care. And that means that this is serious. So I would have liked to have seen that handled a little better. But and in the future, when we come up with passionate discussions, let's give it a chance. Right. Sometimes we need a good, passionate debate to clear the air and let everyone know where we really stand. If we don't inject passion into the conversation, then we just keep moving forward, right? And that's how we get to the problems that we have today.
Yeah, repressing the problems and mm-hmm. bottling that energy up is going to lead to an outburst. And the symbols go back not just to the 19th century, but they go back to the 20th century, where people were trying to impose segregation and all kinds of repression of minorities. So now, anything that you're going to do on the Board of Supervisors, because there are 6 magisterial districts, there are 6 supervisors, it takes 4, all of them in agreement, in order to pass any ordinance, any resolution. So if you're elected to serve on the Board of Supervisors, how will you work with other supervisors to get things done?
Great. So contrary to what we see in the popular in the national media, the answer is found in the middle, and to the middle of either to the left or the right. So I'm all about someone that wants to get everything, wants to get things done, and wants to compromise. And so I'm coming from a team aspect, knowing that we need to get things done. No matter how much I yell and scream, my one vote is not gonna pass if everyone's not with it. So I think on a lot of these issues, I think we can come to an agreement somewhere. The board members are reasonable. Like I said, I have no issue with the board. So I think that we can come to an answer that fits in the middle. So I would definitely take a team approach and one of an open mind, that the answer is somewhere in the middle and that we can find something that works best for the county.
You think it's this is the bottom and the draw. Do you guys think it's a good idea to have 6 counselors where you need kind of a supermajority, 4-2, as opposed to a simple majority if they had an odd number? I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing.
It's a little odd.
But it's a little even.
Actually, that's a better way to put it. It's a little even. I don't know. It's a little even. But I guess if you were to have 6 reasonable members, I guess that's better than 7 off-the-rails members.
All right. Well, the fundamental structure of county government, 6 part-time elected supervisors, plus an unelected full-time county executive and staff, would challenge the ability of any group of people to work together effectively. What do you imagine the county government could do to accomplish more? And what role does the state government play in what some would consider to be local dysfunction?
Right. So the state government, we know they provide the purse strings. So on issues such as affordable housing and becoming environmental friendly, it would be wonderful to have more funding from the state. So they control the purse strings on what we can really do here. On a local level, I think when we set our priorities and getting everyone on board from the full county staff, as well as the Board of Supervisors on board with these priorities and really working to be innovative in government, I think there's a chance for a government to be innovative. We often think of government as being like stagnant, maintaining, no real innovation. But I think in today's time, I think there's a place for policy innovation. And so if we can get buy-in and get all the minds together and really dedicate ourselves to being an innovative government that's working in the best interest for a multitude of people in different aspects, I think there's a chance that we can push this thing forward and really set the standard for a big county. We're a big county. A lot of counties aren't this big. We're big. We've got different needs. And it does take buy-in. So it's kind of it's kind of good that we have the setup that we have with the board and then the full-time staff. It gives us a chance to really work on these issues. I know as a part-time member without a full-time, if this were a county where we didn't have the full county staff, this job would be, as a board of supervisors, would be impossible, slash a headache, slash the mental services, health services that we talked about earlier. We're going to need all of those. So,
in a the city has made a bunch of noise. I mean, they're really being aggressive as it relates to the University of Virginia to get a collaborative buy-in. Mm-hmm. In what areas do you think Albemarle could best collaborate with City of Charlottesville, UVA, and neighboring counties? Because as you mentioned, we touch numerous. I mean, mm-hmm. we go from Buckingham to Nelson to, I guess, Augusta. We touch at some level up there, or at least we're very close. What do you think we can do to work better with our friends?
I think number one, in terms of an issue that we can work better on, I think we can really give an effort to working with public transportation to make sure that CAT is running effectively. And in terms of, I think we need to reevaluate as an area, in total, the idea that we are one area and that we can move together, that what's good for the entire county is good for everyone. We know that Charlottesville is the heartbeat. We understand that. We need Charlottesville. We need better city-county relations, and that's one thing that's on my list of to make sure that we solidify that relationship and take that to the next level. But I think it just comes from an understanding of, hey, this area is a big area, and we need each piece to survive. And then hopefully that can rally the troops, and we can come together and push this pot forward.
So every year about this time, or at least every year about some time, the issue of revenue sharing comes up. The issue of the county of Albemarle a long time ago voted in mm-hmm. to stop annexing, they would pay all Charlottesville a sum of money. And that sum of money is in the tens of millions of dollars. Mm-hmm. And I can appreciate, as a county resident, sort of mixed feelings about that. Where do you stand on that?
I think that we should. I think there's a chance to kind of revisit the argument. Revisit the agreement. If we take a look, that agreement was signed when? 1970-something?
Long time ago.
And how many things do we have that are still in place from 1970?
We got the statues.
Yep, exactly. So I think there's an opportunity to revisit. And I understand that it's a mixed issue. People fall on both sides. The city falls on one side, county falls on one side. But I think that we can revisit and see if we can make that mutually beneficial. Once again, I'll just say that a lot of things from 1970 have kind of gone away, as we've seen that it's not that productive. And I'm not trying to get rid of it, but I think that if we want to revisit it and take a look at it and see what it looks like in 2019, what's reasonable, what's not, I think there is an opportunity to do that.
What do you think?
If we want to rely on 1970 agreements, then I guess that's where we're at.
What do you think about UVA? What can the county do to foster a beneficial relationship or a more healthy relationship with the university?
I think UVA can absolutely do more. These are our citizens, right? So for UVA, they look at them as employees, which is fine. Look, they have employees, they have students. For the county, they're our citizens. So I think UVA can really take a look in their role in affordable housing, their role in where their employees park. I know a young woman from out in the county who has to leave for work probably 30, 40, 50 minutes before she would usually have to, because she can't find anywhere to park, and then she has to ride, and then she has to wait for a bus that's not coming all the way on time. And so I think we can look at those to see how UVA can help benefit the citizens of Charlottesville and Albemarle. There does need to be a disconnect of, hey, we're UVA, and we have, and this is what we provide. We're not going to help you guys. I think that, and it's deeper than that, and that if we realize that these are citizens, these are regular people, and what can we do as an institution that's right in the heart of Charlottesville, that's right in the heart of Albemarle, to benefit these citizens that are traveling from all parts of the county to come work, and from even outside the county, what can we do to make them a little bit better? I think there is a role for them to expand in affordable housing, parking, transportation issues, things like that. I think that they do have a role to play, and I think that we can examine it and move it forward a little bit.
One of the things that's been suggested is that UVA have upperclassmen, you know, second-year students remain on campus, or in grounds, excuse me, remain on grounds rather than moving into the communities adjacent and forcing the rental rate to the availability rate is real low. How do you feel about that?
That's a tough one. Regardless of whether UVA has places a restriction on that, the kids are still going to do it. And so I don't know if, and so I'm not sure about that one. I think that's a little bit harder to restrict that movement. I would much more be on board with trying to reduce the number of cars for people that live on campus. And if we can get our public transportation system working efficiently and make it a little bit better, then maybe one day there won't be a need for a student that's staying on campus to have a car, and maybe we'll be able to ease the burden on our environment and our city and our infrastructure a little bit better.
You're listening to 94.7 WPVC's Albemarle Board of Supervisors Forum interview with Gerard Smith. I'm Bob McAdams. Gerard, you're running for the Board of Supervisors. Now, how do you describe your candidacy, your campaign, to voters in a moment or two when you have them at the door, and you're canvassing door-to-door, or in an elevator?
All right. So one thing that I always try to harp on, and it's because I mean it, is that I'm a citizen that's from here that's trying to get back. That's number one. Number two is that I'm one that's really about creating opportunities and breaking barriers for all citizens in this county. And number three is my ultimate goal is to make sure that this place, this county that we love so much, is one that regardless of whatever background you come from, whatever religion you come from, whether you moved here as a professional, whether you came here or whether you retired here, that this is one that you can live whatever life you so choose. And so that's really what I'm all about. That's really what my policies are about. That's really who I am as a candidate, is really taking a look at how can we make Albemarle County beneficial to each citizen, regardless of where they come from, their financial status, their background.
Every campaign needs to pay for basics to get the candidate's message to as many people as possible. Flyers, hand cards, signs, advertising. How are you going to raise the funds to pay for those basics for your campaign?
Great question. So this is my first foray into the public office, and raising money is definitely an important part of it. So I'm learning as I go. We've been on the phones. We've hit the streets in terms of canvassing, getting signatures, and now we're about to start canvassing. But the part that I don't like, most candidates don't like the call time. I actually welcome the call time. I think I've had some great interactions with people, and I'm learning a lot from people. So we've been on the phones raising money, and soon we'll start having fundraisers and things like that. I've got some creative ideas for fundraisers that I can't tell you guys just yet, but be on the lookout for them. I've got some unique fundraisers to kind of get involved in both the rural and the urban parts of the county, but it's a process, and I'm definitely taking the steps to do it. So call time at fundraisers.
So I know you have a challenger for the Democratic nomination, but is there a declared candidate for the Republicans in this race yet?
I have not heard of one just yet, but I think that they are under different timelines and things of that nature. So I'm not ruling that out just yet.
I think they have till June 11th to declare whether they're going to run or not. But it's interesting that they haven't come forth with they're certainly not having a primary.
Yeah, it is interesting. And as much as I didn't want a primary, I think it's made me a better candidate because I've had to get things up and off the ground and sharpen my skills early. So I'm running this one for the primary, this campaign. I'm running this as one, getting ready and trying to win this primary, but two, I'm still running this thing because of the primary as if I were having a challenger. So I'm meeting people, I'm getting different ideas, I'm on the phones, I'm fundraising, I'm canvassing in an effort to be the best candidate possible. I don't want any mistakes, even if a surprise does come up.
Yeah, that leads us into the next question. The primary is June 11th, as mm-hmm. I just mentioned. It's coming up quick. Mm-hmm. To get elected, you've got to become the Democratic candidate for supervisor. Tell me a little bit more about the organization you're building to accomplish that. Like, do you have a campaign manager? Do you have an office? Are you Are you active on social media? What is your, what's your game plan?
All the above. So I do have a campaign manager, Peyton Palmerton, who's been extremely helpful. And he's been keeping me on track with call time and things of that nature. I've been an involved citizen in this county for a while. As I mentioned earlier, Democratic co-chair for a while. So I'm really just taking the same steps that I've been taking in terms of a presence, as my presence in the community. And then from there, we're on social media, and we're just, we try to represent a genuine candidate. One thing that I really want, and I think the politics needs to return to a little bit, is being genuine, right? Can I be the genuine candidate that wins in the county and tries to push the needle forward? If I can be, I'll be happy. But one thing that I don't want to do is get out here and portray myself as something that I'm not, or make up issues and hyper politicized issues just to get a vote or a click here, a click there. I'm a reasonable citizen, born and raised in this county, one that's trying to do its best to connect the people to this community and make government work a little bit better. And so that's what I stand for. So I'm just working on being a genuine candidate and taking all the steps necessary to get the votes.
So what's the best way for people to get in touch with you and your campaign to learn more about where you stand on the issues, how to volunteer, and from your perspective, how to donate?
Great. So my website would be the best hub to get all that information, which is smith4bos, like Board of Supervisors.com. On there, you can sign up for information. You can contact me. All my contact information is on the website, but that's the best way to get in touch, to donate, to find out more about me.
Okay.
And so, yeah, I'm a regular person, so I'm an open candidate.
So let's ask an important question. Did you watch a game on Monday night?
Yes, I did. And it was incredible.
It was. Are you going to the celebration today?
Tomorrow.
Well, we're recording it on Friday. Yeah. We're airing it on Saturday, Bob.
Yes, I'll be out there. So I have to support my Hoos.
As will I. You know, there was a little pushback in the community about the joy and celebration that this brings. Not everybody was so excited after August 12th, you know, people are struggling to find joy in a lot of things. Mm-hmm. And I know this is a question that we're pulling out of left field, but what do you say to the people that are struggling to find joy in what I consider to be an extraordinarily joyous occasion?
I think that this is the time, this specific moment in Albemarle County UVA history is one to celebrate, right? Like, there are a lot of things that we can harp on that aren't good, that aren't bad, but this was our first one, right? If I'm correct.
Oh, yeah.
Very first.
So this is our first one. So this is the time to celebrate. If you would like to be that person, that likes to throw rain on the parade, then that's your prerogative. But this specific moment is one to enjoy. You don't have to enjoy UVA just to glorify UVA and the county for all that it's done, and it's great. But this men's basketball team, this championship, I think it's a celebratory moment.
Proudly displaying two Albemarle County Patriots.
Yes. Yes, one from Albemarle High School.
Unfortunately, we've run out of time. Gerard, thank you so much for spending this hour with WPVC listeners. This is one in a series of election special interviews with candidates in our area seeking the nomination for city councilor, county supervisor, delegate, and state senator in the June 11th primary. So, Bob, tell us what's coming up in the future.
Well, next week we're going to have B. Kirtley in here, who's also running for the Democratic nomination for the Ravenna District Board of Supervisors seat. And then after that, we're going to go to the state level. We're going to have Kathy Galvin in, who's running for the 57th House of Delegates District seat. And then we'll have Sally Hudson coming in, and they're both competing for that Democratic nomination for that seat. Following them, we're going to have Amy Laufer, who's running for the 17th State Senate District, and her opponent is Ben Hickson. We'll have both of those in, and we're going to learn all about them, find out what they're thinking about on the issues, and how the state can help the municipalities of the city and the county do their job better.
Well, thanks, Bob. It's been great. I'll see you next week.
You've been listening to the 94.7 WPVC Election Special Candidates Forum. The program is brought to you with support from Rebecca's Natural Food and Hamilton's at First and Main. Join us again next Saturday at 11 as we talk to yet another candidate for local office in Virginia's 2019 off-year elections. You can hear this program again or suggest questions for upcoming guests at 947WPVC.org or link to it through our Facebook page. Thanks for listening.